Breaking It Down with Frank McKay. This is 103.9 LI News Radio.
Welcome to Breaking It Down. Our guest today is Graydon Clark. Graydon is a director. And I hope you don't mind the term cult film director. Does that bother you?
No, not at all. I'm happy to do it. Almost all my films are very low budget. Cult is a good word for them.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's a badge of honor. I mean, it's, you know, to go in there with a huge budget is one thing, and to overextend that budget usually happens with the guys with the big budgets. But you went in there, and you did, almost guerrilla filmmaking in some cases. Am I right?
Absolutely. I started in the very late 60s and continued into the 2000s. And I was very, very lucky to, at this point, I've directed 20 different features.
See, that's a good number. And the people that are really into films and into certainly cult films, Roger Corman, for example, is one of your contemporaries. Did you get friendly with Roger at all?
You know, I met Roger several times. He distributed one of my films. And I've always said that Roger Corman was, if not the smartest man in the industry, certainly one of the two or three smartest men in the motion picture industry in the last 30 or 40 years.
What made him so smart? What was it about him that stood out?
Well, he was able to view the trends of what the audience wanted to see even before the audience was. He would sit down and he would come up with a thought or an idea for a picture, and he would be able to tell if the audience was going to like it or not. And obviously, it's show business that we are in, and the last word is business. If you can't, you can make a great show, but if it doesn't return its investment or make a profit, you'll have a very difficult time making the next picture.
Hmm. Yeah, well, certainly around that time period, so much was going on. And I want to ask you a little later about your experience with Martin Luther King. I am right that you had some relationship there?
Well, I would like to claim a relationship, but I think that's probably overdoing it. When I was very young, before I went to Hollywood, I was born and raised in a small town in the Midwest.
We're in the Midwest.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
We're in the Midwest?
Just north of South Bend, Indiana, a little town called Niles, Michigan. Has about 10,000 people when I grew up there and still has about 10,000 people. Hmm. And I foolishly dropped out of college. I was on a basketball scholarship, and one summer when I was working in a factory, I gashed my hand rather badly and couldn't play ball for about 6 months. And like an idiot, I dropped out of college and went to work at a local car agency there in South Bend. And Martin Luther King came to South Bend. This was in 1963. Just prior to the JFK assassination, Martin Luther King came to South Bend, and there was a parade in his honor. And I was, as I say, working at the car agency selling cars, or trying to. And none of the other salespeople would participate in the parade for Dr. King. And I was always a very liberal guy in all aspects. I'm very interested in politics throughout my life. And I was appalled that the white salesman felt that way. And I stepped forward and eagerly volunteered to drive one of the automobiles in the parade. So I was really a driver for Dr. King. I would like to say that I did more than that, but to be factual, that's all I did. And
did you drive his car?
It's one of the proudest moments in my life. And years later, well, actually about not quite 10 years later, I had shortly after the Martin Luther King parade, I left for Hollywood. I wanted to be an actor. And and struggled for, oh, 3 or 4 years before I got my first role. And then I got a little tiny role, and then I started writing scripts and eventually writing and directing and producing. But about 9 years later, I made what is called a blaxploitation film called The Bad Bunch. And it was a very powerful film about race relations in the United States. It was really the second film that I made, and it was the first film that I had any recognizable actors. I had Aldo Ray and Jock Mahoney playing two racist cops who fixate on the leader of a small gang in Watts, and I also had a part in it, and I played a white returning Vietnam veteran who befriends the black gang, and the cops don't like it, and therein is your conflict in your story. And it was quite a successful picture. It helped me a great deal in my career, because after that I was able to basically make one picture a year for the next 20 years.
By the way, Graydon, if I could interrupt, I just want to remind everyone who they're listening to, Graydon Clark is a wonderful filmmaker, and as he mentioned, he's got 20 features, but he makes these movies, these successful movies, on shoestring budgets, to say the least. And in the cult picture world, Graydon is an absolute legend, a very talented man, and a very bright guy. It's the first time we're getting an opportunity to speak. But let me ask you, what was that movie originally called, Tom? Was that the name?
Yes. It went through several titles. We filmed it under the title, are you ready for this, Lurgan Lover, which was, of course, a very offensive title, and it was supposed to be offensive because it was about the white cops beating on this black kid. And then when the returning Vietnam vet, played by myself, befriends him, the character that I was playing was referred to that way. And it was very explosive. It played throughout the United States, mostly in the inner city, in the black market. And it, at that time, films called blaxploitation films were quite popular. And it was really the first, I can't say the first, one of the first looks at what was going on in our society today. And in fact, the film ends with the famous quote from Dr. King, that I have a dream that someday the slaves, that the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will sit down together at the table of brotherhood. So it was a very political film. And as I say, it was the second film that I made. And it was really very important in my career. And it really talked about the politics. It was anti-Vietnam. It was, of course, anti-racism. And it examined the young man that was living in Watts and compared his situation with the young man that I was playing, the returning Vietnam vet who was living in an upper middle class white society, and they clashed, and the white cops were the reasons for it. I remember we screened the picture for MGM to see if we could get distribution. And the guy at MGM, the sales manager, really liked the picture, but he said that there's no way he could have MGM release a picture that had two white racist cops beating up a handcuffed kid in a back alley in Watts. And then he said to me, he said, "I'll tell you the truth, Graydon. My brother is a cop in New York City, and what you show in the film happens all the time, but we can't be associated with it." So we got an independent distributor, and the picture, as I say, did well. I just finished my autobiography, which is called, appropriately, On the Cheap, My Life in Low-Budget Filmmaking, because all of my films were done on a very, very minuscule budget, some tinier than others. But almost all of them were done the equivalent today for $300,000 or $400,000.
And what was the film that we just spoke about originally, well, I won't mention the word on radio, but at one point was called Tom.
Yes.
Now, what was that movie made for? How much money?
Well, I'll tell you the actual figures, and you will think I'm not telling you the truth.
Go ahead,
but,
try me.
We had $12,500 to make that picture.
Wow.
And this was in 1973, so I don't know, I guess you would double or triple that for in today's dollars. But in those days, there was not the digital video, which we have today. Today, a struggling filmmaker can go to Best Buy and buy a digital video camera, shoot it for the weekend, and then take it back to Best Buy and say he isn't happy with it and get his money back. And you don't have to have film. You don't have to have laboratory.
Yeah, it's true.
In those days, I had to make a deal, which I did, with the laboratories. And they were almost $25,000 just for the lab work, and then another $10,000 or $15,000 for the raw stock for the film. So when I say $12,500, that's the cash I had to pay everybody. And then I guess the expression is beg, borrowed, and stole everything that I could to get the picture made.
Graydon Clark is our special guest today. You're just tuning in. In the world of filmmaking and especially cult films, Graydon is a legend, and I'm not overstating that. You never even had the budgets that Roger Corman had. I mean, Roger Corman is considered a low budget guy. You came in way under that.
Well, I did. Roger had huge success early on in his career. He was involved with American International Pictures, AIP, and they distributed his pictures, and he made enough on those pictures that he kept increasing his budget, and eventually he got to where AIP was financing him. And of course, eventually he got so big that he left AIP and started his own companies. Roger started New World Pictures, and in those days, your picture, a low-budget small picture, could get a theatrical release, their home video of any kind. VHS, it was before VHS, certainly before DVDs, before the internet, almost before computers. And so Roger started his own theatrical distribution company, was very successful, but again, he saw the trend of what was happening. And I would guess in the mid-80s, he realized that theatrical distribution for low-budget films was being taken over by home video. So he sold his theatrical distribution company for, I don't know, the reports were $12 million, $15 million, whatever it was, a huge profit in those days, and opened a home video company. And then he had that for 7 or 8 years, very successful. And then he realized that home video, Blockbuster, et cetera, was going to go the way of everything else, and that is eventually have to change to something easier and better to work. And that, of course, was the Netflix and the direct video through your computer. So he sold his home video company and made millions. Roger Corman was and is a very, very clever guy.
Well, yeah, that's putting it mildly. Listen, yeah. You haven't done too badly yourself here. Now, when you changed the name, well, actually, let me go back to your film, right? The one that really broke through for you. When you talk about an African American at the time, Negro, black, I don't know
at the time, black.
Black, okay. So a black man is being beat up in Watts. Now, this is right off of the Watts, you know, not too far after the Watts riots. Was the reason?
It was a couple of years after the Watts riot, and the community of Watts developed a summer festival day. Actually, it was late summer, and they had rides and carnivals and stuff like that. And we actually shot a scene with our black actors actually chasing me through the Watts summer festival. When I made the picture, as I say, it had this very offensive title, and I was of course, appalled at it. But but I thought that it carried a message that I wanted to carry. And when I was casting the picture, I asked the black actors what they thought of the title, because I really didn't want to release it under that title. And to a man, every single one of them said, no, you've got to release it under that title, because it tells the truth of what our life is really like. So we did release it under that offensive title. Eventually, when it came time to release the VHS and now DVD version, we did change it to The Bad Bunch. And I think that, for its time, was more appropriate.
Right.
But the original title, for its time, I think, was more appropriate.
Now, what did you make on that film? Just curiosity. What I don't mean you personally, but what did it bring you?
You know, what I made was enough to make my next picture. What happened was this. The distributors did really well with that first picture. And they came to me and they said, we want you to do another blaxploitation film. And I said, oh, I really don't want to do that. I don't want to do it about a cop or a drug pusher or a gang, and that's what they wanted. They wanted an action exploitation film with a black character as the leading character.
They wanted Shaft on a low budget.
They wanted me to make another Bad Bunch.
Right, right.
And I said to them, well, I have no problem with making the leading character. At that time, I started to say African-American, and I wouldn't have said that then, because at that time, the proper verbiage was to use the word black. So I said, I have no problem with making a black actor the lead. Let me think about it and get back to you.
Right.
So I thought, well, I didn't want to make, as I say, another inner city black picture. And I thought, what if I create a character, African-American character, who is a wealthy Beverly Hills successful businessman. And at the time, Warren Beatty was making shampoo. And I thought, that's a good idea. Why don't I make black shampoo?
Wow.
So to capitalize on the publicity that Beatty's shampoo was going to get. So I created this character who was an African-American, successful Beverly Hills owner of a beauty salon. And I did it as a comedy, but also, again, the distributors insisted that it have plenty of action in it. So I get my successful Beverly Hills businessman character involved with the mafia, and then there's action and violence. And of course, there's sex and there's humor and there's all this stuff. And that picture was, again, quite successful. That picture cost me about $50,000 to make, and I got back around $300,000.
See, that's nice. So, that's good money back then. Hey, let me jump in just to remind people who they're listening to. Graydon Clark is once again, I don't want to use this. You overuse this term. I don't want to use hyperbole, but as far as cult film directors go, you know, there's Roger Corman, and then honestly, there are other people there, but it's a very short list. Graydon Clark is one of the legends of low-budget films and guerrilla filmmaking, really. I mean, they're calling it now. I mean, it's...
Well, it was guerrilla filmmaking, and I feel honored, and thank you for mentioning me in the same breath as Roger, but I'm not sure that I would agree with that.
Well, he just made a lot more money than you. He might be a better businessman than you, but you made some great films on very... very, very small budgets. I mean, $12,500 even back then is ridiculous.
Yeah, it was. I was very, very lucky in my career. I as I say, I was born and raised in a small town in the Midwest, and I went to Hollywood in January of 1965, knowing absolutely nothing about how films were made. In those days, they didn't have the behind-the-scenes documentaries. I had no idea what a director did. The only thing I knew is the director was the last name on the credits before the movie started. But I always loved the movies. I loved all kinds of movies, and I went to every one that came to our little town. But I dropped out of college and was floating around trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life. And I had never acted. I had never been in a school play. I had never done anything. But I somehow decided, well, what the hell? Why not try acting? And I knew that most, or in those days, almost all the movies were made in Hollywood. So I hopped in my car. I drove to Hollywood. I remember I had $150 in my pocket. I did not know a soul west of the Mississippi River. But I arrived there after, I guess, 3 or 4 days on the road, and rented a flea bag hotel just off Hollywood Boulevard. And 2 or 3 years of acting lessons and absolute struggling, not even really being able to get interviews with anybody. I lucked out and I met Al Adamson, who was a low budget filmmaker. And I met him through a girl in acting class, and we became friends. Eventually I wrote a script called Satan Sadist, which is a motorcycle picture that Adamson did. And I was lucky enough to get a real good part as an actor, having written a script. I wrote the part for myself. And then I wrote another couple of scripts for him and would get small acting parts. And then I bumped into a friend who had the $12,500, and I made the Bad Bunch, and then Black Shampoo, and then after that was successful, and it was one series of complete lucky events.
Hey, Graydon, hold your thought right there. We're coming up on a break. Do we have you for another segment?
You got it.
Graydon Clark, filmmaker. Graydon Clark is our special guest, and we'll be back with Graydon right after this. Welcome back to Breaking It Down. Our guest today is Graydon Clark. He is a B-movie, cult movie filmmaker extraordinaire. He has learned how to make very little turn into a lot, and he's giving a master class as we speak right now. Right before the break, you were talking about getting the $12,500 from somebody and then going into Black Shampoo. Let me ask you real quick about Black Shampoo. And folks who don't know, maybe folks that are too young, Warren Beatty had that had the movie Shampoo come out. It was a big hit, and you know, it was a big sex symbol, and it was him as a hairdresser and everything else. Did you get any legal were there any legal ramifications for doing that? Did you get sued?
You know, I was told that I would be sued. And I said, gee, I hope Warren Beatty is foolish enough to sue me. I would love the publicity.
Yeah, right.
But he wasn't. He's very, very smart. And he just let it go. He did make a comment in Daily Variety saying, well, yeah, he makes this guy Graydon Clark, who the hell ever he is, he makes Black Shampoo. What are they going to do, make Black Gone with the Wind? And then the guy from Variety, Army Archer, was the columnist. He called me and for my comment, and I said, oh, Black Gone with the Wind, that's a good idea. I'd love to see the Civil War from the point of view of the slave instead of the slave owner. But no, he did. He just ignored it, and the picture played, did very well, and I was very pleased with the results of it. And, you know, I'm going to take a second, Frank, if I can, and plug my book.
Please.
My autobiography, which is called, appropriately, I think, On the Cheap, My Life in Low-Budget Filmmaking. And I do go in, I go in great detail how I made these pictures. In fact, I wrote the autobiography in screenplay format. And I break it down as to where the idea for the story came, and then the screenplay, how that was developed, and then how I raised the financing, which is extremely important, obviously, how I raised the financing for each of the pictures, and then the pre-production, the casting of the pictures, and then the actual production, then the post-production, and then the distribution, and the results of the film. So I break it down, and I do think that if a if a person has interest in how low budget films are made, they can learn a lot by my autobiography, and it's available at my website, www.graydonclark.com. I even give away a free DVD of one of my films from my personal library if a person orders. They can also get it, of course, through Amazon and Kindle and so on. Well, I've got that little plug in.
No, well, listen, let's talk about the book for a second here. Now, this is the first time you wrote a book?
Yes, yeah. Well, as I say, it's my autobiography, and it really covers the years from when I first got to Hollywood up until almost the present day. I finished it about 3 months ago, and the response really has been terrific from, I guess, young filmmakers or even people that remember the films when they were playing in the theaters. Because, again, it breaks down how the pictures came to be. I mean, a lot of biographies, and I've read dozens and dozens and dozens of biographies from mostly filmmakers, some actors and so forth, and they always talked about, you know, being on the set and how they were made, and I enjoyed that tremendously. But I always wanted more. I always wanted to know, well, where did the idea for the story come? And how did you get the financing to make this? And what about the editing and the music and the post-production? And then how about the distribution? So I decided to break each of my pictures down as to all those categories in screenplay format, so that a person could read it, and I write the dialogue that I would have with the various actors and distributors and so forth. So it's kind of an interesting, different take, and as I say, the response has been tremendous.
Graydon Clark, author Graydon Clark and filmmaker Graydon Clark, he wrote the autobiography entitled On the Cheap, and that's very appropriate, as you said, because you make cheap films. I shouldn't say you make cheap. You make inexpensive films.
They were cheap.
They're right.
I had to make them cheap. And one difference that a lot of independent filmmakers like myself have versus those that are at a studio is let me give you an example. The picture right after Black Shampoo is a picture called Satan's Cheerleaders. And I had $75,000 to make that picture. I took the money that I made from Black Shampoo and I put it into Satan's Cheerleaders. So I had 75 grand, but I didn't have 75,001. That's all I had. So as an independent low-budget filmmaker, you have a budget, and therefore you have a shooting schedule, and you have crew, and you have cast, and you have all those things, but you can't go over on any of them. If you're working for a studio, and you're shooting the picture for X number of days, weeks, or months, however they want to break it down, if for whatever reason the director needs an extra day or two or three or sometimes at the studio weeks or months, the studio can just write the check and have it done. But as an independent low-budget filmmaker, I had 75 grand. I had to make Satan's Cheerleaders, and I spent about 25,000 on the stars of that. So that left me with 50 grand to make the picture. Well, to make the picture for 50 grand, I had to shoot it in 2 weeks, 10 days. So I had to make it work in 10 days. And if something went wrong, I would really be screwed because I didn't have any more money. So there are things that you have to do as a low-budget independent filmmaker that, you know, are a necessity. An audience doesn't care about if a picture is made for $50,000 or $50 million. And they shouldn't care. All they care about is, do they enjoy the picture? Do they like the picture? Has it been an entertaining hour and a half or 2 hours for them? And that's all they should care about. So in my book, On the Cheap, My Life in Low-Budget Filmmaking, I go over in detail what compromises I had to make. And they're not excuses, because I agreed to make the picture for X dollars. So it was something that I was happy to do. and frankly felt very, very lucky to do. And I made the pictures on the budget. I never went over schedule, not one day in any of my films. And I never went over budget because I didn't have a choice, probably.
The name of the book is On the Cheap. It is the autobiography of our special guest, Graydon Clark. And let me ask you something, and I don't want to pretend to be a psychiatrist here.
No, please, anything.
And I don't want to sound trite in saying this, but in being a low-budget guerrilla filmmaker, is there a validation that comes in writing an autobiography? And when I hate to say, was it therapeutic? But, I mean, did it help validate you in your mind that all of these things that you did over the years meant something, right? This isn't... you didn't have to become Coppola, you didn't have to become Scorsese, right? But when you lay it down on paper and you start laying, or on computer, I don't know how you wrote it, right? On computer nowadays. Right? But is there a validation to that, or did you have that already?
You know something, that's a good question, Frank. And to be honest with you, I wrote the autobiography, frankly, because so many people asked me to. It never occurred to me. I mean, when I was making these pictures, I was just hoping to make enough money that I could pay my rent and feed my family and make another picture. That's all I cared about. I had no idea that an audience was being created for these films, or that anybody even knew who the hell I was. So as the years went by, a number of people, I would say in the many dozens, came to me over the years and said, geez, it's great. You've done all these films. You've worked with all this. I mean, I worked with the Academy Award-winning actors. I worked with first-time actors. I worked with Academy Award-winning cinematographers. I worked with first-time cinematographers. You've done all this. Why don't you write your autobiography? Well, you know, I thought, I don't really want to do that. So about 2 years ago, I finally was convinced, mostly by my two sons, oh, Dad, you got to put this out. You got to put this out. Look at all the people that have asked you. So I sat down at the computer. It took me a year and a half to do. And had I known how difficult it was going to be, I don't think I would have done it. Because what I did is I went back, and of course I have DVDs of all my films. I went back and I looked at each of the films to remind me of, you know, the actors and what was going on behind the scenes and so on and so forth. And I sat in front of the computer and I wrote this autobiography. And I looked at the films and it was agony, because every single film, all I saw were my mistakes. And believe me, they are legion. Because I would say, oh, why didn't I take another take on that actor? Or why didn't I position the camera over here? Or why did I agree to do this in 2 weeks? I should have known better than that. So it was difficult to write it, because I wanted to go back and remake all the films. Mm. You know, I mean, yeah. How did I make so many mistakes? So, and I talk about the mistakes while I was writing it, and talk about the compromises that I had to make. But basically, I start, the first line in the autobiography is, I was born lucky, and I believe that. And the last line is, I got lucky, maybe you will too. Because I do think that luck plays an important, very important part in a person's life. And I also feel those of us who were lucky or are lucky owe a debt to those that have not had the breaks, that have not had the luck. I mean, I gave David Caruso his first acting role. I got him into SAG. I got Andrew Dice Clay his first acting role. I put him into SAG. But I had a dozen or more other actors who I gave their first acting role who, in my mind, were just as talented, just as clever, just as good-looking, just as everything as Caruso and Clay. But for whatever reason, they became international stars. And I had one guy who starred in one of my pictures gave a tremendous performance. The picture was a success, and he never worked again. And he tried. Believe me, he tried. And I would say to him, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, that's just the way it is. So when I look back at my career, which I've just done because I finished the autobiography about 3 or 4 months ago. When I look back at my career, luck played so much a part of it. I mean, the first acting role I got was because I happened to meet a guy through a girl in an acting class. You know, and he happened to play basketball, and I was a basketball player. So he invited me to go to the YMCA to play basketball, which, of course, he was the director of a film. So naturally, I did. And we became friends, and, you know, he gave me parts. And then I started writing and did my own stuff. And I would get lucky and find investors. And I would it's psychologically interesting that when I would sit and I would go from picture A to picture B to C to D to on. And I would sit and I would say, well, I just finished an example. I just finished Satan's Cheerleaders and it was a success. So what's my next picture? I had no idea. And I happened to read an article. I'm an avid reader and I still do read a newspaper every day. And I read an article in the Los Angeles Times about street racing, about kids who would get drag racing. They would go down to Van Nuys Boulevard, which is a street in the San Fernando Valley adjacent to Los Angeles, and they would parade their hot rod cars, high riders with jacked up rear ends, and they would make bets, and then they would go to another area out further away from the cops, and they would drag race. So I thought, geez, that's a good idea for a movie. Hmm. So I wrote a script called High Riders, which, again, was a very successful movie. Is really the first movie. Let's see, High Riders was my fifth movie. Yeah, was my fifth movie. And that made me enough money that I never had to worry again about paying the rent. When I first got to Hollywood, I mean, I was eating 15-cent hamburgers to live, and I was in a rental that in those days was $75 a month. I was collecting unemployment, and I would have to say to the landlord, listen, you got to wait for my unemployment check to come in before I can pay the rent. So I went from struggling. Let's see, that was 65. High Riders was 77. So what is that, 12 years? So I struggled, well, more accurately, I struggled probably 7 years and then had 3 or 4 or 5 years of pretty good. But after High Riders, I never had to worry again. Now I had to worry what was going to be my next picture, how was I going to get it financed, what have you. But I didn't have to worry about paying the rent. And yet there were people in my acting class, other actors, male and female, who were much better than me, and they never got that break. They never had that chance. So I do feel that there's an obligation that people who have been lucky, whether they're inherited luck through the Lucky Sperm Club, or they get lucky in their career, I think they do have an obligation to those that have not been as fortunate.
I'll tell you, if you're just tuning in, please get this book. I know I'm going to get the book, and I say that to a lot of guests, and I'm sometimes disingenuous when I say it. I say I'm going to read this book. I'm going to read your book. It's called On the Cheap, and it is all about the life of Graydon Clark. And again, give the website again, Graydon, if you can. It's such
it's
a
my name. It's Graydon Clark, GREYDONCLARK, GraydonClark.com.
And
you can go to you can go to Facebook, Graydon Clark, and you know it'll guide you through to my website.
Graydon Clark again is our guest. We have about 4 minutes left with Graydon. And what do you do nowadays? I mean, what's your project? What keeps you going?
Well, you know, I have a picture, or I should say, I made a picture in 1980 called Without Warning, which a lot of people know. It's one of the one of my films that gets the most response online. And as for from 1980 until present, we've been trying to get a DVD, a home video release, and have not been able to do it. But we finally worked out the various rights issues. And in August, a DVD Blu-ray is coming out on Without Warning. And I'm doing promotion work on it, and I'm doing a director's commentary on it. And I actually plan to give it away with the purchase of my autobiography on my website. So, but it'll be available because it's being released. MGM had the rights for years and years and years and years. And we finally got them to okay a DVD Blu-ray release on it. So it'll be all over the United States.
See, and now it's nice to get your work out there, but also that's a boon for you. That's a financial windfall potentially for you. Am I right?
Yes.
Yeah, and that's a big part of it. I mean, look, I always hate getting personal with financial questions, but not really. I mean, I think people that are listening, and certainly filmmakers and people that follow filmmakers, they want to know. I mean, I'm always interested in you know.
Well, I'll tell you what. In my autobiography, again, I'll plug it, called On the Cheap, My Life in Low-Budget Filmmaking, I go in detail as to what every picture cost, where the money came from to make the picture, and then the distribution deal. I did a picture called Joysticks, which was the number one picture in the whole United States when it first played, the week it opened. And my share of that was $1,200,000. Hmm. And the distributor went bankrupt, and I collected absolutely nothing. So that was a difficult time, as you can well imagine. But, you know, somehow I survived it and went on and made another picture and another picture. I think Joysticks was my 10th picture. So it was right in the middle of the 20 that I've made so far. And I thought when that picture opened, I thought, oh, my God, I've finally done it. I mean, I'm legitimately a millionaire. My share of this deal is $1.2 million. Hmm. And we had no idea that within 6 months, the distributor filed bankruptcy, and we collected nothing.
Graydon Clark, we have about a minute left with you. Interesting, you mentioned your two sons. You have two sons?
Yes.
No daughters?
No, just the two boys.
Two boys. Are they in the business?
Well, one of them is a television sports reporter, and the other is studying for a doctorate in climate change. Climatology, I think it's called.
Well, he's going into a good field. And he's got your liberal bent, I guess, right? You got that liberal bent.
I think that I have brainwashed both of them successfully.
Well, listen, you've had some life. And I mean, just absolutely amazing from, and again, I know you point out that your proudest moment was Martin Luther King and driving for him. Were you driving for his car? His actual car?
No, I was the car behind him. And they had, I don't know, three or four of his associates in the back. But then we went to a parade ground or a playground, I think it was, where they had set up a stand, and I was there listening. And obviously he was a great, great, great man.
No question about it. It's a sacrilege to cut you off on this point, but we're coming up to the end of our show.
No, that's fine. I fully understand.
I hope you talk about that in your book, because that's...
I do. I do in detail.
We have been with the author of On the Cheap and a guerrilla filmmaker extraordinaire, a filmmaker, just period, extraordinaire, Graydon Clark. Graydon, it's been a pleasure, and I'll go further than that. It's been an honor to talk to you. What a career and what a life. Graydon Clark, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.